KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on the author of the new book, Piracy, The Intellectual Property Wars from Gutenberg to Gates. The author is Professor Adrian Johns of the Department of History at the University of Chicago. And this is truly, I think, the definitive history of piracy going back all of those centuries. I'm very excited to have Adrian on today discussing this history of piracy and what it means, not just tracing it step by step, but the insights into what we mean by piracy and what piracy has meant through the millennia. This has been a topic, certainly piracy, that has been front and center not only in the press, but also on Hearsay Culture, as literally from the beginning of the show, I had guests on to discuss piracy and how we deal with it and how regulations should deal with it or not. And certainly we've had guests on that run the range from people in the copyright maximalist world, from Harry Fox agencies and others, to the polar opposite, people like David K. Levine and Kelly Boldrin, who have advocated that these systems and IP in general should be thrown out the window. So we've seen a variety of views on these issues. And here we have the opportunity to chat with a preeminent historian looking at the history of piracy and what it has meant and done through the ages. Adrian Johns, as I mentioned, is a professor in the Department of History and chairs the Committee on Conceptual and Historical Studies of Science at the University of Chicago. He's also, in addition to this book, author of the book The Nature of the Book, Print and Knowledge in the Making, from the University of Chicago Press in 1998, which won a number of awards. He was educated in the United Kingdom at the University of Cambridge, as also taught at the University of Kent at Canterbury, the University of California, San Diego, and the California Institute of Technology. And again, he is someone who I'm very excited to have on the show and who I very much appreciate taking the time to join us. He's joining us by Skype from his home in Chicago. Adrian, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Adrian, let's start off with a question that I ask virtually all of my authors. Can you talk a bit more about your background and how you became interested in the topic of piracy?
Sure. Well, I'm a history of science person by training. Back when I was in the UK, I my first and second degrees, actually, were in this field called the history and philosophy of science. And at that time, I got very interested in how people during the scientific revolution, so roughly the time of Newton, Kepler, Copernicus, tried to make use of the printing press to advance their various visions of how science ought to work. And that's the story that's told in The Nature of the Book, the volume that you mentioned. The one of the things that struck me about that period, though, was that in the period from roughly about 1500 to 1700, at the beginning of that time, you never see references to piracy per se. You know, people complain about, you know, works being plagiarized or something like that, but you never see it referred to as piracy. But by the end of the period, you see the term piracy being thrown around all over the place. And I thought that was a very interesting phenomenon that you would have, on the one hand, the development of many of the ways in which print has been put to use in the sciences, and on the other hand, the rise of a notion of piracy, that these things are more or less coincident. So I started looking into what was going on then and trying to figure out why the notion of piracy got invented. And that then ballooned into a bigger project about the whole subsequent history of it from about 1600 to now. And so it comes out of the history of science, really.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. The history of science is a field that intersects obviously so much with intellectual property law generally, and obviously with our conceptions of technology today. In terms of writing this book, why write this book now? Did you perceive a particular need? Were there events that you thought warranted this history? Is the timing of any relevance to our discussion?
Well, it's obviously the case that you know, piracy is a huge economic and cultural issue. I mean, you just pick up any newspaper, if people still do that, and you'll find discussions and diatribes about it. So it's partly just that. It's partly that it's one of the biggest, most discussed problems of the day. But there's also a reason why it's so big, which is that as we move to being an information culture and an information economy, so piracy has taken on a role as almost the definitive transgression of that economy. The other thing is that I do have the sense that maybe in the next couple of decades we may hit something like a crisis point when the various contentions about intellectual property that you mentioned in your opening discourse actually hit home, and we could see a real transformation in how we think about the relation between creativity and economic culture. So now seemed like the point at which to talk about this historically, to give some sense of what the trajectories are that go from the beginning of modernity to now, in the hope that if this transformation does come about, that we may have a better handle on it.
The book itself is voluminous, as any good history should be. Voluminous not in the sense, of course, of filling pages, but voluminous in the sense that you cover quite a bit of ground, as you mentioned. Where do you situate your book in the literature on piracy? Where do you place it?
Well, there's a lot of books on piracy, as you know. Most of them come out of things like the law schools or business schools. The overwhelming majority of these books are normative in intent. They want to identify some problem which can be treated by, say, a reconceptualization of a piece of legal doctrine or a new policy that might come about through Washington, or sometimes new strategies that might be pursued by businesses. So the intent is to have what in the business world is called takeaways. My book is not like that. I mean, it may well be that people have takeaways out of it, and I'm very happy for them too, but it's not meant to be normative. It's meant to be interpretive and descriptive. So I have no particular, big policy beef. I'm not trying to urge a particular doctrine on anybody. The idea is very much to provide an interpretation.
And so, as
I think that's unusual in that genre. There aren't very many books with which it would really compare, I think.
And I agree. And I wanted to ask you along those lines, because you're writing obviously as a historian, excuse me, as opposed to an advocate or an attorney or a law professor, but someone viewed more directly on the law, or perhaps with a particular position to advocate. What has been the reaction from people who have read your book from that perspective? In other words, do you have people that wish that you would be more of an advocate, or have people valued the book for the purposes that you described?
Yeah, it's early days yet, but the reactions that I've heard from people have been basically positive and engaged. I haven't had anybody tell me that I ought to be more of an advocate. I have had people tell me, and I think this is a legitimate thing to tell me, that I ought to go more into the, as it were, practical, everyday conduct of the law. That is, not just what the state of the law is, but how the law is actually put into practice in courtrooms. So I talk a fair bit about the mundane realities of creativity out there in the world, in things like labs or going back in time in publishing houses. But I haven't talked about the courtroom per se. And I think that one of the points that's been made to me is that I should have talked more about the courtroom. As I say, I think that's entirely legitimate. I probably should have done.
And along those same lines, as we think about these issues today, and going back the millennia that or the centuries that you have identified, and we're going to talk about some of those threads in a moment. One, I think, at least someone that writes law review articles as opposed to works of history thinks about is how one goes about writing a book and researching a book that spans several centuries. Given that this show, and one of the goals of the show, is to bring diverse disciplines together, I'm curious to ask a historian who is speaking to many lawyers and certainly law professors to talk a bit about that process. I mean, what do you see as the fundamental challenge? And perhaps you could start with what is your process for putting together a work of history of this magnitude?
Okay, that's actually an excellent question because it's not obvious, and for a topic like this, it's actually especially tricky, you know, because people think that piracy is a byproduct of something else, you know, so it itself wouldn't have a kind of integrity. It wouldn't have a history that would go back for a long period. There are a few basic rules of thumb. One is that you have to pay very close attention to what historians call actors' categories. That is, look and see what people at the time called a kind of action. You know, did they call it piratical or not? Their decisions about what to call these actions don't necessarily map onto ours. And you can find out something very interesting if you try to tease out the ways in which they don't correspond to the way that we would talk. So that's the first thing, is pay very close attention to what the people at the time were actually calling these acts. The second thing is look for controversies, because when people argue about something like piracy, they force each other to justify their positions. And if you go back through the long series of controversies about this topic, you'll find a long series of people justifying various stances about how creativity and commerce should intersect. So one of the main rules of thumb that I've had is to go back and ask in each generation, what were the biggest bones of contention at that point about piracy? And use those as kind of keyhole points into trying to work out the culture of piracy and intellectual property at that period. So those are the two big things.
And with regard to that latter point, what kind of resources did you have to turn to? This sounds like a logistical question, but I guess I'm asking, in terms of sources that you went to that perhaps you were surprised to find were fruitful, were there any particular sources or places that you turned that initially, when you started doing the project, you wouldn't have thought you would have been looking to?
There's a quite a wide range of sources in this. So it goes not just through books and law cases and things like that, correspondence, but also sound recordings and movies. Trying to think of things that were particularly surprising. I had some this is actually not in the book per se, but I did go out and spend a few days interviewing street sellers of pirated DVDs in Beijing five or 6 years ago. And they had some interesting things to say. And so, for example, I found that some of the police who seemed to be monitoring what was going on out there were actually pirate police, as it were. They were not real policemen. They were dressed as police, and they were in fact collaborators, as it were.
Hmm.
So that was something that surprised me. It's a very kind of disconcerting experience if you're used to living in Western countries like the UK or the US. To find that kind of perfectly openly on the street, there are uniformed policemen who are actually completely bogus.
And perhaps you could talk about, because I'm not sure that I've heard about this particular phenomenon before. So perhaps you could describe that in more detail. You went on the street in Beijing to speak to the purveyors of pirated DVDs, and we know that that China is one of the major focus points, certainly of the content industry and going after international piracy. How did you approach them, and what did these people look like? What kind of uniforms are you referring to?
This was in the early 2000s, so about 2002, 2003. The way it worked then was that, at least for the people that I was talking to, they would be you know, standing in the street, and close to them would be something like a big hold-all, carry-all sack full of DVDs in cases. There was this one guy who was sitting on top of what looked like a World War II motorbike with a sidecar, and in the sidecar there were stacked up DVDs. But right next to him was this policeman, and I kind of shied away a bit because I thought I might get into trouble. I was just trying to do a kind of amateurish ethnography of these guys. I wanted to figure out where they came from and how they got into the industry and so on. But as we started talking, the pirate essentially waved this policeman away, and he went off about 20 or 30 yards and stood there smoking a cigarette or something. And I spoke to the pirate for about 20 minutes. And then when we finished, he waved the policeman back, and the policeman came and sat down on the motorbike. And at the time, I was a bit baffled by this because, you know, the actual letter of the law in China for some time has actually been, you know, quite up with WTO guidelines and that kind of thing. So to actually have quite such overt failures of monitoring, as it were, seemed surprising. But the person who told me that this was quite likely a bogus policeman was actually a Hong Kong official. After that, I was in Hong Kong, and I spoke to the official in charge of the Hong Kong government's intellectual property policy. And he said, oh, no, this was probably a make-believe policeman. He said it's quite common in Beijing that this should happen. So it's rather hearsay. But that was probably the thing that was most unexpected to me.
And so
you would find it going that far.
Yeah, that is fascinating. And so from your perspective as a historian and writing this history, what did you draw from that experience? How did that experience in particular influence the writing of this book?
There's a couple of things. One is just don't have preconceptions about the limits of this kind of activity. And if you go back and you look at debates in the Enlightenment, for example, you'll find people urging that the reprinting of philosophy, say, has major cultural impacts that go beyond the merely economic. I think something like that was going on then. The other thing is that when I was out there talking to these street seller people in Beijing, there was a slightly spooky aspect to it, which is that the sky was a kind of murky orange color. And it turns out that this is a product of topsoil rising up into the atmosphere and moving out over the coast. And the people who were selling these DVDs overwhelmingly came from the same region in China where this topsoil was disappearing from. It's an effect like America in the mid-20th century. So I got the impression that villages were being, you know, depopulated as their young men and women went out to Beijing without travel licenses, which you needed at that point. And they were sending back to their parents in these villages where agriculture no longer functioned, the income that they got from selling these DVDs. So there was a kind of strange concatenation of nature and human movement here. And that's something which, again, looking back in time, you start seeing that the connotations of piracy are not, you know, they're not just a given, that you do find that these kinds of strange effects to do with changes in natural knowledge, say, because I'm a historian of science, this grabs my attention, might correlate with the spread of piratical activities.
We're chatting with Professor Adrian Johns of the University of Chicago, author of the book Piracy, The Intellectual Property Wars from Gutenberg to Gates on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Adrian, I'll ask you the omnibus question now, which we can then drill down on. Is there a standard or is there a basic definition of piracy that withstands the centuries? And if not, are there certain elements that have defined what piracy is meant going back to Gutenberg?
Yeah, I don't think that there's a single short definition of it. Nowadays, obviously, it refers to violations of intellectual property, however intellectual property is construed or defined. But intellectual property itself as a concept is not that old. It dates back to, maybe to be generous, the early 19th century. And people have been called intellectual pirates for at least 200 years longer than that. So in that preceding period, I think it referred to something that you know, there is the It refers to a breach of legal notions of restriction that exist surrounding literary or mechanical products. These are things that later would be subsumed under the concept of intellectual property, but weren't yet. But I don't think there is a single short kind of categorical definition that you can give to it.
And that's where I think we can drill down on particular points in time. We can start from today, and you mentioned this a bit earlier, but I want to spend a little more time on it. In the beginning of the book, you refer to piracy as a defining element of modern culture itself, and certainly there's been writing, again primarily from a law perspective, and also by technologists that have talked about piracy as a not only a modern but a good form of the creation of new works of authorship and so forth. Perhaps you could describe a bit more what you mean by a defining element of modern culture.
Okay, there's a couple of things. One is that because we now do live in an information world, the symbiosis, if you like, between upholding intellectual property and what are perceived to be transgressions of intellectual property really do play a defining role in how our economy and our culture operate, how information flows through our world. That's the contemporary one. The other point goes, going back in time, is that repeatedly back through the Renaissance, measures to define what we think of as intellectual property, like copyright, for example, have actually been invented in response to piratical challenges. You know, we tend to think that piracy is a response to intellectual property, but that's actually historically topsy-turvy. In each case, the rule has come after the transgression. That means that what the rule is owes a historic debt to what the transgression is, if you like. So the nature of copyright reflects what the fears were of piracy in the 20 years or so before copyright was invented in 1710. And that's a coherent pattern that's repeated over the centuries.
And that pattern, I think, leads to a question about cycles and whether they exist. I mean, as you look back at how piracy has played a role in cultures, are there particular circumstances where it's been accepted as a legitimate form of innovation? And we've had some guests on Hearsay Culture recently who have talked about piracy, or at least copying, as opposed to piracy, which implies, as you mentioned, something violating a norm. At least copying as being a good thing. Are there circumstances where it has been accepted by a society or by a culture as a legitimate form of innovation or the creation of new works?
Yeah, though usually what's tended to happen is that when some form of copying has been accepted on that basis, people have defined piracy to mean, you know, the next kind of copying, which is illegitimate. So the term tends to have its meaning shifted by that. But a great example is Ireland in the 18th century, when there was no law of copyright at all, and it was hard even to identify practical norms of literary property. So the Irish publishing industry in the 18th century actually went through a boom period by systematically reprinting works from London in particular. And then sometimes partly for the Irish market, but partly for re-export into England, where they would be sold a lot cheaper than English imprints. For the London trade, that was almost the definitive piratical act. But of course, the Dubliners would not condemn it as piracy at all, but they thought that it was a central part of Enlightenment and national improvement. There's a long debate about that, which runs from really the 1720s through to 1800, when London subsumed Ireland into the United Kingdom, and at that point copyright law was extended over Dublin, and in fact the Dublin publishing industry essentially collapsed at that moment.
And that leads to something that, since you mentioned it, I wanted to perhaps mention. So I had my to the extent that I've done a lot of history work as a student, I had spend some time looking at British economic history under Professor George Boyer at Cornell, who is someone that I really have come to admire and served as a wonderful mentor for me. But we read books like Outcast London and other books that looked at British economic policy during the time of the Poor Laws, when windows were being taxed and so forth. And this is a very sad but certainly important history that allows us to think about labor economics and how people live. With regard to that historical period, and I'm really thinking from you know really 1700 to about 1850 or so, and I'm using that loosely, do you find that there's a correlation between the economic state of a country, in other words, good times versus bad times, and the willingness or lack thereof to countenance what we would call piracy? Is there a relationship? Because certainly at the time of the Poor Laws, laws were being enforced in a rather draconian way, and as you talk about a bit in the book, to the extent that people had intellectual property rights, they were granted on a favored basis as opposed to something that we might call merit.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It hasn't occurred to me to try to look for a correlation that would be that direct, but I think there's impressionistically, yeah, there's a certain amount of evidence that you could appeal to which would imply that that's right. I mean, for example, in the 1760s and 70s, there's a time of a certain amount of economic stress in England, and a time of transformation of the empire, obviously. It's a moment when anti-monopolist feeling ran high in London in the streets. There were riots in the streets, and a lot of opposition to the biggest monopolist of all, which was the East India Company, a huge operation that essentially ran large parts of India through the mid-18th century. And that's also the moment when agitation against the publishing monopoly, what we would call copyright, ran at its highest. So the definitive ruling that limited the term of copyright is 1774, right at the peak of that period. And I think you can say something too about the period in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars, when there was a severe economic slump in the late 18-teens in Britain. And that too coincides with a period of agitation about copyright, about its limits and about its violations. One of the aspects of that is that, especially in the 18-teens, a lot of the piratical acts are politically inspired. There's a kind of proletarian piracy movement, if you like, that sees the repropagation of a lot of French Enlightenment works, which are, at least by the lights of the British government, dangerously materialist and insurrectionist. So at that point, it's not just a matter of trying to breach kind of trade monopolies or industrial monopolies. It's what you breach the monopolies with, that what doctrines are you actually circulating. So there's a number of very notorious late Georgian, early Victorian print pirates who are actually quite ideological about what they're doing.
We're chatting with Adrian Johns, professor at the University of Chicago, author of the book Piracy, The Intellectual Property Wars from Gutenberg to Gates on KZSU-FM and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture and make a donation, and we'll talk about Hearsay Culture later on. To make a donation, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, I do hope you continue to listen not only to Hearsay Culture, which we'll talk about ways you can get that show at the end, but also that you consider making a donation and listening to KZSU regardless. Adrian, towards the beginning of your book, in chapter 3, the piratical enlightenment, as you call it, you quote a poem written by, as you call him, Grub Street Whip, Ned Ward in 1700. And I'm not going to do an attempt to do a rendering of it, but I will read a little bit of it because we referred to it very generally in this battle between pirates and publishers. And I'll read it because I think it's a good jumping off point. The poem that you quote, so these are Ned Ward's words and not yours. A throng of angry ghosts that next drew near, large as a Persian army, did appear. Each to the rest showed envy in his looks, some writings in their hands, some printed books, the learned contents of which they knew no more than the calf skins their sundry volumes wore, down from the bulky folio to the 24. As they pressed on confusedly in a crowd, "Piracy, piracy," they cried aloud. "What made you print my copy, sir?" says one. "You're a mere knave. 'Tis very basely done." And it refers to, and there's a bit more of the poem, which I'll skip now, but it refers to, as you talk about in this history, a very pitched battle between publishers and pirates. Can you talk a bit about that? Because it sounds eerily similar to the kind of battles that we deal with today.
Yeah, sure. That poem comes about really at the peak of the first generation, when piracy was invoked as a kind of intellectual crime. The background to this goes back to the English Revolution in the mid-17th century, when in the 1640s, what had been a kind of censorship regime essentially collapsed as the civil war between king and parliament got going. And the output of the press really leapt upwards. So there were thousands of pamphlets being produced every year by the mid-1640s. And that never really quite got clamped down again, on again. The result was that through the Restoration period, that is 1660 onwards, when the monarchy was back in power, there was great unease about what the cultural role of publishing actually was and how you should regulate it. And the first generation of feuds over piracy comes out of that unease. So it's really driven by an attempt to use patents to regulate the press. There was an attempt to try to monopolize the reproduction of law books by getting out a patent on all books of the English common law. And to justify this patent, the patentee, would-be patentee, came out with an argument that the craft of printing was actually owned by the monarch because it had been introduced into England back in the 15th century at the expense of the then king, and it had never been sold, so it was it was the king's property. And therefore it could be allocated out by the king through patents, which were a branch of royal prerogative at that point. As part of this, he accused essentially the entire publishing industry of being pirates because they were ambitious, lawless challengers to royal authority. And it's that rhetoric that you see being echoed in the poem by Ned Ward, because the ubiquity of the charge of piracy is one of the things that Ward is picking up on. If you went and spoke to booksellers, publishers, printers in about 1700 when Ward was writing, you would have found the charge of piracy being leveled at all levels of the trade, not just at kind of backstreet operators, but at some of the leading publishers of Augustan England. And the copyright law, first copyright law, which was created in 1710, is an attempt to try to restrain that situation, which people fear might become somewhat anarchic.
The focus there on this issue of patenting laws, of course, is one that I would expect certainly my intellectual property survey students to scratch their heads at and say, well, doesn't that just violate all of the rules that we think of about why we have patents in the first place? And yet there was something, as you describe it, called the law patent. More specifically, what was it? And how does it, or how does its existence connect to the information control battles that exist today?
Yeah, there's a problem where one talks about patents in the 17th century, and it's easy to think that they can't have existed that way because this is not what patents are. But patents then were different things. They were used for all kinds of regulation of practices. It's simply an open letter from the monarch or the government, whatever the government is, enjoining obedience to whatever the letter says. And you could get patents for new inventions, but there was no guarantee that you would, and there was no guarantee that a patent actually covered something that was new. So, you know, patent monopolies were given out to all kinds of bits of the economy, without there being a real claim that there was a new invention at the heart of them. Now, those tended to be very controversial, because if the state gives out a patent to a part of the economy which already has a trading community in it, then that community can claim that its property is being violated. And it's part of the constitution, going back to Magna Carta, that violating the property of a London tradesman in particular by royal prerogative is you know, outlawed, essentially. That's not what you're supposed to do. So through the 17th century, that use of patents was extremely controversial. And this, the law patent is just one instance of this. It was an attempt by a retired cavalier soldier, that is a soldier who'd served under Charles I, to recoup a fortune by monopolizing the trade in books of the common law, even though there was no real claim that, that these books were actually new or anything like that. They weren't a new invention or a new trade. The idea was simply to extend royal control over them and to profit from that. It's really the 18th century when you start to see a much stronger association between patents and novelty of invention. So it's in the 18th century, for example, that you start to see things like a relatively regular filing procedure, with things like the requirement for a specification to be lodged. And it's only in the 19th century, at least in Britain, that you see something like a modern patenting system coming about in the 1850s. The US is actually earlier. The US has one pretty much from the beginning, but in the UK, it's only in the mid-19th century that things get really modernized and bureaucratic in the way that we would recognize and think to be normal.
And that, and that's where I think it's, we can drill down a bit more too, because as you mentioned, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the U.S. Constitution refers to the production of useful arts, and conferring these monopolies, although there's a call it that, for limited times. We don't see that. Well, certainly don't see Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 in the constitutions of other countries. And I was wondering if you had an opinion on that. By making copyrights and patents a constitutional element of the U.S. government, does that or did that impact the development of the country itself versus countries that didn't have that idea as early on and hadn't put it in a founding document?
Yeah, I think it really did. Not in a direct way that you could actually track by some kind of you know, textual legacy, but it's certainly the case that from very early on, the ideology, if you like, of the American Republic involves a strong component of inventiveness, independence of thought, that kind of thing. And the patents and copyright regimes get associated with that. So one of the things very striking, if you're viewing it from the context of London or Paris, is that the American patent system from quite early on, it involves the submission of models, and these models are put on public display in a kind of museum in Washington. There's nothing like that in England until quite late on. In fact, arguably never. There never has been anything like that. But it was a very telling gesture that you would say that a central part of this new nation is that it's full of people inventing things, and here are the models that represent their inventions. So it's a way of representing the virtues of the country to itself, as it were. So I think that the patent system especially comes to be associated with Americanness quite early on. Copyright is more problematic because of the issue of transatlantic copying of texts through the 1820s and 30s. But even there, to some extent, it's true.
And your that last comment with regard to displaying these works gets to one of the fundamental trade-offs that exists certainly in patent law, which is the disclosure requirements, at least in U.S. patent law, in return for getting this limited monopoly. How do these ideals, these democratic ideals like transparency and accountability, which are again are popular topics that we talk about theoretically today, how do they fit into the history of the regulation of piracy?
Yeah, there's a very interesting subject there that people have not really looked at enough, which has to do with how in practice you manage the relation between transparency and, if you like, uniqueness or holding something to oneself. The requirement for lodging a specification is an 18th century one in Britain, and it goes back to the beginning in the US. There's a real art, though, to constructing a specification in such a way that it reveals enough to specify, but not necessarily enough that people could actually emulate, as it were, that could reproduce the device in question. And they're developed a kind of discrete industry of patent specification designers who had the skills to do this in the 18th century. In that respect, the issue is one, like so much else of intellectual property, where you need to look beyond doctrine and look at how the doctrine is actually carried out in practice, look at who the people are who are actually making it real on an everyday basis. The other thing that one says is that with high industrialization in the 19th century, there's a big push, not just in Britain, but in other European countries as well, to severely limit or maybe even abolish the patent system, because it's held that bargain between revelation and limited monopoly is not working. That essentially it's become a form of class warfare, that the rich patentees are essentially accumulating more and more and more patents and keeping out small inventors. So in the Netherlands, in Switzerland, in Prussia, there are more or less successful movements to restrain the expansion of patenting. And in the British Empire as well, there was a movement like this which came quite close to success. So it's something that at that moment, in the high point of the Industrial Revolution, it was very much a debate. And you find that some of the terms in which we now have debates about intellectual property actually descend to that debate in the high industrial period. So the notions, that, for example, that there is a kind of intrinsic human urge to invent. The patents are not needed to encourage invention, because the urge to invent is a kind of intrinsic natural one to humanity. That's part of this mid-19th century debate originally.
We're chatting with Professor Adrian Johns at the University of Chicago, author of the book Piracy, The Intellectual Property Wars from Gutenberg to Gates. Adrian, we have about 10 or so minutes left, and I start asking questions that I call the unfair questions, because we don't have enough time left to really get into them. But I'll ask a few as we think about where we are now and where we're going. One of the big issues currently facing the world, really, with regard to piracy, is the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which has been negotiated under a severe shroud of secrecy, but which purports to set an international framework and indeed create a new international institution specifically to deal with piracy. Have you followed this issue at all, and do you have any opinions or thoughts on it?
I followed it to some extent, not in the kind of detail that the real experts have. My concern about ACTA is not so much with the text itself; it's with the environment into which it's being launched. There's a growing kind of multinational industry of intellectual property policing that involves lobbying, technological devices for surveillance and interdiction, lots of engagement with the public police forces of various countries in one way or another. One of the things that it may be ACTA is going to involve, it's hard to be sure because, as you say, the negotiations have been carried on in some secrecy, would be a protocol for allowing that industry to take action outside of, as it were, the conventional legal system. So you could, as a citizen, you could have your internet access shut down on the basis of what are essentially technologically mediated suspicions on the part of ISPs or information providers that provide suspicions to ISPs. There are some certain countries that already have rules like this, and they're very controversial because of the fact that nowadays, and increasingly so, access to information is really part of citizenship. That seems to be clear. And the idea that it can be cut off without there being some kind of public hearing or inquisition is politically and morally dubious. So my concern about it has to do with what will be its implementation, as it were, by this developing kind of technological enterprise that exists.
Do we have, are there any historical antecedents for something like ACTA? And I don't mean a law dealing with piracy, but a law created in secrecy to create international institutions. I mean, I know obviously we have laws like TRIPS, and we have entities like the WTO and WIPO that exist today. But going back further in history, are there antecedents to something like ACTA and the secrecy involved in its negotiation?
I don't know about there being things which have that degree of secrecy and which are not to do with something like national security. I mean, a certain amount of confidentiality makes sense, of course. I mean, you want these discussions to take place within spheres of expertise, and they could be held up forever if they're just open to all and sundry. But with ACTA, it seems like it seems excessive. And I don't think that that's been a characteristic of intellectual property negotiations internationally going back to when they started, which is really the mid-19th century. There's an interesting precedent in one sense, which is that when the campaign existed in the 19th century to sign the United States up for international copyright, this is a campaign that ran for something like 40 years before it eventually succeeded, one of the major counterarguments to the bid to sign the US up for international copyright was the idea that this would be done by treaty, and hence it could get through with only oversight by the Senate, not the full Congress. And you would therefore have something like a regulation of internal commerce and industry within the United States without proper oversight by public legislatures. And it looks like there may be a challenge to ACTA on very similar grounds to that, if it really has the status of a treaty.
We are chatting with Professor Adrian Johns at the University of Chicago, author of the book Piracy, The Intellectual Property Wars from Gutenberg to Gates. I should point out, by the way, that we're recording the show on November 15th, and literally what that means from ACTA's perspective is that for all I know or all we know, ACTA will be law by the time this show airs, which is about 10 days from now, as the best guess that we have is that it's going to be done any day. Like everything else involving ACTA, no one's really clear on what's happening or when, but I wanted to make sure that was pointed out, given the discussion and the timeliness of it. In the remaining about 6 minutes that we have, 5 or 6 minutes, Adrian, in terms of where we are today, based upon the historical precedent, what do you see as the most pressing piracy issue facing the world? And I don't mean that in terms of necessarily a type of piracy, but perhaps an issue of conceptualization or regulation. What do you see as the most pressing issue that we have to address?
Yeah, I think that the one that could blow up in everybody's faces is pharmaceuticals. And I'm not alone in saying this or thinking it, because of the ever-increasing kind of political stresses that exist around pharmaceutical patents and their impact on the provision of medicines to especially poorer countries. The industry tends to dig in its heels about things like compulsory licensing, which are legal under certain circumstances under WTO type regulations. But the industry tends to really oppose them very strongly because it sees them as the thin end of a wedge that would really take away the entire patent-driven research funding and profit funding engine that exists at the moment in pharmaceuticals. So I think that geopolitically, the production and circulation of pharmaceuticals is probably the thing that is going to be most explosive for the next generation, just because the issues of life and death loom very large in it.
And do you think that there is, and this perhaps is a loaded question, but do you think that there is an understanding of the history, and this is also a history that you go into in the book, the history of such patents among policymakers? And I guess the broad question is, at a broad level, do you think policymakers are aware of and consider this history in crafting the rules that are being decided now?
No, I don't think that they know any of the history of it at all. I do think that in the last few years we've started to see a slight kind of moderation of the path towards ever-increasing protection of intellectual property. Slightly less so in the United States maybe, but more in Europe and other countries. There's starting to be a slight sense that there may be more voices to be listened to than the lobbyists of the big information industry corporations. But I think as far as understanding the historical trajectory is concerned, no, I don't think there's any notion of that. People have, at best, a very sketchy notion of key doctrinal points, like copyright goes back to 1710, or there's that clause in the American Constitution. They know those things, but they have no sense of what the history of practices has been, or what the history of arguments has been. So they don't know where the arguments that they themselves are making have come from often.
So this last question or two are kind of and you mentioned and we chatted a bit about takeaways, but I am going to ask you this. So assuming that you have the opportunity to recount one of the stories and one of the points of history that you mention in your book to policymakers, what story would it be, and what lesson would you want to derive from it?
Wow, what a question. I think it would be a story that actually occupies a rather small part of the book. It has to do with record piracy in the mid-20th century, the 1930s through the 1950s, when in two parts of music especially, opera and jazz, in the United States there were thriving communities devoted to producing what the industry called pirated LPs. These are often repressings of classic recordings that the industry was kind of sitting on, and it wasn't going to reissue them because its costs were too high and they were never going to recoup them. The point about that is that the pirates of opera and jazz were quite explicit in arguing that there was a moral economy involved in reproduction, as well as just a monetary economy, a financial economy. That there's a responsibility of care about culture that lies on an agency, a company or an individual who has ownership of something like intellectual property. That involves a responsibility to safeguard it, to guarantee some degree of public access at some point. And they would legitimize what they were doing in terms of this kind of conception of there being a moral economy as well as a monetary one. And I think that's the point that I would want Congress to understand, not necessarily in exactly those terms, but that whenever legislation, for example, is introduced to strengthen intellectual property, it impacts on what is a moral process as well as an economic one.
The book is Piracy, the Intellectual Property Wars from Gutenberg to Gates. The author is Professor Adrian Johns at the University of Chicago. Adrian, thank you much for joining us today. I mean, to cover a history of this volume in 50 or so minutes really does not do justice to it. It is a remarkable work of history as well as a fascinating one, and I'm very excited to have had you on the show to chat, and I will invite you back perhaps sooner rather than later once ACTA comes into law, as presumably it will eventually, although maybe not, but be that as it may, I'd like to have you on at some point in the near future to continue the discussion. But again, thank you much for taking the time today to chat with my listeners.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I'm very excited to mention rounding out this quarter, which is coming to a rapid close. Rounding out this quarter are a number of guests that are upcoming. But rounding out this quarter is one particular guest I'm very excited about, which is Nick Bostrom of the University of Oxford, who will be talking about not only machine intelligence, but also issues involving transparency as well and taxonomies of it. And then Hearsay Culture is going to be during the intercession between quarters on KZSU on hiatus, and we will be returning in towards the end of the year during the winter quarter to pick up our shows, and there are a number of guests coming on that I'm very excited about, and you can pick up that schedule by going to hearsayculture.com. So we have one more show this quarter before the end of the year, and I look forward to chatting with you then. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show primarily by listening from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU on Wednesdays. You can also pick up the show by podcast by going to Stanford Internet and Society's Center for Internet Society's iTunes page. You can also pick up the show by CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and you can pick up all of the shows by going to hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome comments, suggestions, feedback, and so forth at dave@hearsayculture.com. I do have a full slate of guests at this point for the winter quarter, but I'm always interested in booking guests down the road, and so I'm really looking for guests for the spring quarter of 2011, which will begin sometime, I'm just guessing at this point, but sometime in March or April. And you can always email me with suggestions on guests that I should have on at hearsayculture.com. So thank you much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I do hope you enjoyed the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.